Welcome to the Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea Reedy. This show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today, we're thinking about connections and collaborations. We're thinking about gathering grounds. First, Colette LaBeouf talks with Wah Ming Chang. She started low-key reading parties, which began in March 2020 at the beginning of the quarantine. These virtual gatherings started with the idea of getting together to hear one another read out loud in a space that was, from the start, one of generosity. A little later, we'll hear from Andy Murphy, creator and producer of Toasted Sister, a podcast where industry chefs and food historians familiar with indigenous foods of native tribes discuss, reflect, and build on the origins of the mutual relationship between indigenous communities and food. This music is from Last to Know, a musical collaboration spanning almost 20 years. A little more from Last to Know, and then we'll hear from Wah Ming Chang and Colette LaBeouf.
I do want to talk about the low-key reading parties, but I want to talk about before the pandemic, what kind of collaborations you were doing, or in what ways were you bringing people together like this, if you were?
There were some collaborations that had started and stalled, and for whatever reason, I found the physicality of it, you know, meaning just being out in the world, to be a little bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. And so those collaborations, there were some that were sustained, but not sustained in a way that whatever this is right now.
So also, what kinds of collaborations, like reading, mm-hmm. or writing, or were they other kinds of art forms?
It's basically reading and writing. There was basically something of this started in person form in 2017. My partner and I just basically wanted to have a bunch of people over, mm-hmm. but we wanted it to be structured, and we called it a salon. And it was October, and I decided I wanted to be Janet Cardiff's 40-part motet that Halloween. It wasn't that I had, you know, people singing choir music, but I had them send me their voice, then basically set up a whole sound system around the apartment and played all the voices at once, so that they echoed each other. Most of the times were asynchronous, but sometimes echoed each other, and that was a lovely feeling. Mm-hmm. And then invited people over to have dinner and to experience this together. So that was the first iteration of that. And then this year, in fact, we decided we were going to formally create a salon series where every single month we would have a similar night where there would be this, you know, amazing meal cooked, and then we would withdraw to the middle room where there's a projector, and then I would put up the images that I would ask people to send me beforehand, and then just basically ask them to talk about them. The first time that happened, actually, there was an iteration of that even before the Halloween voice thing, where, yeah, I just asked people, you know, just send me three photographs or three images, mm-hmm. and then come on over, we'll have a meal, and then, you know, do whatever you want with talking about them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't expect anything, really. I just figured, oh, people will send, you know, travel photos or something, or photos of their pets, I don't know. And what happened was, that night, it was such a delight and such a surprise mostly a delight, that most of the people there talked about particular projects or obsessions that they had. Mm-hmm. And that's what each of those photographs represented for them. Some of the people didn't know each other, so to reveal that and then to have a conversation about it, that dynamic was supremely interesting to me to see. And so I've been thinking about ways to replicate that in many forms.
So then you were doing that, you were starting that, and then you already had in place this kind of meeting of people who maybe knew each other, maybe didn't, but invited to share. And then the pandemic comes and then things change. Did you decide right away, I want to continue finding a way to nourish yourself and each other with this kind of meeting? Or how did it come about?
It wasn't like this immediate, like, oh, now we can move everything online. Like, let's just do it, you know, the way everybody's doing that now. It was simply, you know, there was a lot of anxiety around, you know, what is going on here? And this is all unprecedented. I didn't know what to think. And I wound up, my insomnia wound up coming back. And I would, you know, wake up at like 4, just not be able to go back to sleep. And there was one night where I just decided, I don't want to just be lying here in bed and freaking myself out. I'm going to read. The thing is, I wanted to hear myself read out loud. I wanted to do it for my friends and record myself. And so I did that. I recorded something and I was half awake. So mm-hmm. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I just had the sense I wanted to reach out and I wanted people to hear me. So that's like how it started in terms mm-hmm. of like, oh, I can use this as sort of a medium to make myself feel, you know, better for at least 5 minutes. I just bought a book, the week or two before, and I decided to open it, and I was just enthralled. And mm-hmm. it was Anne Sayre's The Fool. Okay. It's 3 novellas. It's published by New Directions. They're fictions, but just like very personal and weird. And mm-hmm. The Fool is the first story, and it's about somebody's relationship to the idea of the fool.
And then, so then that kind of led to the reading?
Well, that's when things came into place or fell into place in that, you know, oh, if we're not going to have these salons in person, is there any way? And it's a thing that I do, that I have tended to do for many years. I think just like if I have some like funny project in mind, that I think that can be collaborative and can be elevated in some way simply by the fact that, you know, some very smart people have joined and like can offer their like brilliance, then, you know, why not do that? That's basically what I thought. I was like, I sent out an invitation on Instagram. Again, it was just this Instagram community that I'm on. It was, I think, the weekend after my office closed. And I was just like, I just need to do something, and oh, let's see how long this is going to last. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do it another week. Let's do it the next week. And it became really interesting, a little bit stressful. And
I was going to ask about that, what it was like and is like for you to facilitate this, to be having been the one that invited everyone, but also you're helping to share others' work through the platform too, because they're sending it sometimes directly to you ahead of time, either what they're reading or what they've written. So I'm curious about that, what that role feels like.
I guess if I had to say it, it's a facilitator, you know, which is just that I wanted people to be as stress-free as possible in this environment. So all I asked was pick a book off your shelf. You know, we all, or most of us, have shelves and just full of books that we haven't read in a long time, but we're in the space now where we're at home. And why don't you just pick off a random book and come with like 2 or 3 pages that you want to read. Send me the pages and I'll screen share. I wanted them to just do the easy part, which is choose something that they loved. like, I just wanted to make sure that nobody was stressed out. For me, it was incredibly intense because, again, like, just getting to know Zoom and getting to know this environment of just people sitting in boxed squares on your screen. And I still do this, but it's not as intense anymore. But in the beginning of these parties, I would just stare so intently at the screen and try to let the other person see that I was just there for them and I was listening. Mm-hmm. And whatever you're saying, it is being received. After each session for a few months, I would come away from the computer just incredibly exhausted and just with the sense of, like, I've stared at the screen so hard and I'm not realizing it. It felt like a durational exercise at some point. Oh, that was exhausting. I don't know if I can do another next week. Mm-hmm. And then I would just put out an invitation and then people would show up and I'd be like, okay, I guess there, you know, all right, here's one more week. And then at the end of that, you know, the same feeling. But there's something about the fact that this has gone on each Sunday since March. And there's now this core group of friends, many of whom have not met each other in real life. Mm-hmm. But we know each other to a certain extent, and it's very intimate. For me, at least, as facilitator putting this together, there's none of that stress anymore. It's simply like, okay, I gotta just remember to send out the invitation and I'm gonna see some friends again this Sunday.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me in the times that I have been able to join you is that not everyone shares, but everyone listens. And I think that that's really unusual and kind of also does show the intimacy of what you're talking about, a generous quality in the group, that not everyone has to share, but everyone is there to take in. And I think that's really beautiful. That feels more like an exchange to me, you know, than other ways we've used this platform.
I think I'm very aware of, again, like, just how stressful being on this platform can be for some people. And so my thing from the beginning was just always, you know, come on in. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to show your face, but you can mute yourself. You can put a different background on and do your thing at home. And think of this as like a radio program or something, mm-hmm. where a bunch of people are just going to talk about books that they love. And with this particular group, it's not just talking about the books. It's talking about how they came across the books. It's talking about how these books influence their own writing or the way that they move throughout the world. And it just becomes like each session just becomes this sense of interacting with the world, mm-hmm. because we can't move in the world right now.
I mean, I think about that just in-person reading groups or writing groups I've been in, the intensity of that, they usually don't last long. not because they go bad, but because it's a lot. It's just a lot to be in that kind of space with other writers or thinkers.
That was Wa-Ming Chang talking with Colette LaBeouf about how low-key reading parties that take place every Sunday over Zoom began. When we come back, we'll hear more about how turning to a book on a sleepless night led to a virtual salon joined by people from all over the world who simply showed up to read to each other, to be read to, and to hear passages and poems and thoughts about them. Some of these people had never met, and as the months would pass, the reading parties would continue faithfully on Sundays and nurture wider conversations. Before the break, here's more from Last to Know. Stay with us.
Away in the shadow, baby, we garden rain. Complacent, anxious, tossers by, falling, slipping further behind. Rain's bells, warm calls, cross runs high. Falling eyes, rise and shine, sign. Join the morning up ahead. Take a successful space and we decay to waste. Or lost away in the shadow favorite.
Welcome back to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. We're talking with Wa-Ming Chang, editor and writer based in New York. Chang has received grants in fiction from the Sultan Stahl Foundation for the Arts and twice for the New York Foundation for the Arts, has had writing published in Joyland, Brooklyn Rail, and elsewhere, and is working on an album of fiction called Dream Stamps. Colette LaBeouf talks with Wa-Ming about the creation of virtual gatherings where loved books and passages are shared and where its participants span the miles. Wa-Ming's low-key reading parties, a virtual salon, organically grew into a space where readers also share their images and writing, drafts, processes, and pieces of projects. The low-key reading parties have become a grounded virtual space during a fragmented time.
Before the pandemic, before March, the gatherings you would have at your house, those are people that are close enough or visiting you to come by. But I've seen in your reading parties that people are all over the place.
Yeah, they're all over the place. And I had to figure out sort of the timing of the parties. And 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time seemed to be the sweet spot. And there was the Midwest and the West Coast. I couldn't figure out how to get Asia and Australia, although we have an Australian dial-in every now and then.
Right.
It's like 4:30 or 5 in the morning for them. And when that happens, we're like, good morning, wake up. And then people making the decision at this time to be like, I'm getting out of here, wherever here is. And one friend, Emmanuel, went back to Nigeria, and he's doing this amazing book project. And he called in once, and connection was spotty, and also the timing was like, it was very late for him. And we have a bunch of people from Europe, Italy, Germany, and then there's California and Chicago.
So again, people from all over the place. And then somehow in these sessions on Sunday, you started out with pick a book off a shelf, read something, share something. But lately in the one that I participated in, listening, people had read things that they wrote. And so how has that organically sort of come about?
I think it was organic. Other people might say different. There was a question at the beginning, privately posed, of, you know, oh, when are we going to share our own work? And I was hesitant about that. I just wanted us to, like, just get to know each other. And the getting to know each other in a very, to me, neutral way is just to read the works that we love. Because I feel like sharing personal things, it's this whole other dimension of sharing that I personally wasn't ready yet to facilitate. So finally, this was sometime in July, I asked people to find a draft of something that they had started a long time ago. This particular prompt, it echoes basically all the other prompts that we had done in the past. And then in this one, drafts, in this was mid-July, but to keep it in line with, you know, reading other already published work, you know, find something that resonates with your draft and bring that along as well. And so we read that, and I was completely blown away, the quality and by the intensity and also generosity in the way that people presented themselves and also listened to each other. By that time, July, like we knew each other, and we knew how to talk to each other in terms of, you know, oh, you know, thank you for sharing this part of yourself. From there, I felt very comfortable with the idea of sending prompts that had to do with drafts, your own drafts.
I was just going to say, having taught writing workshops, you're you're saying you're facilitating, but to create these prompts, they're creative, beautiful things themselves. When I look at the prompts, I think these themselves are work. Do you have any sense with the people sharing and participating that there have been connections or projects emerging?
Yes. I'll get a text from somebody saying, yes, you know, this person and I we're getting on a Zoom call later and we're going to talk about, you know, translation, because right. I feel like everything that this person says is just, it just resonates in my heart. And I love that. It makes me also want to reach out to people. But yeah, there are collaborations happening. And it's not just collaborations, it's just conversation. And yes. I think that part of what this space, this particular reading gathering, I think allows is just a little bit of space for yourself and headspace for just conversation about things that you would think about if you were, you know, on your commute to work.
When we all go back to our spaces that are outside our home, if we're working or we're back into some sort of routine that we used to be in, do these continue?
They're going to continue for sure. If only because I see that it's possible and it's baked into my life right now. There might be adjustments every now and then, and we'll definitely have in-person salons, and where people who can't attend can definitely dial in and like be part of a Zoom something.
Right. That's so interesting, because, you know, when you talk to people, and this is just family, friends, colleagues, you know, there is on the one hand the Zoom fatigue or virtual event fatigue that I think people feel because, you know, it's maybe for them often work connected.
Yeah. And for the longest time at the beginning, I felt guilty whenever we went past the 1.5 hour mark, and then it would go into 2 hours. And I would always just feel so guilty, because for the Europeans, at least, right? Like that's, I think, getting close to midnight thing. And I'd just be like, why are you guys still here? Oh my God. And then you're coming back the following week. Like it's amazing. And now it's just officially, we end at, you know, 2 hours on the dot, and it's, I don't know. It's good. It's a full feeling.
But I also have this feeling like, just like what you're saying, that some of this really works, you know, and this is a way for the people that we want to connect with that are not in our just immediate circle.
That was Colette LaBeouf talking with Wah Ming Chang. Coming up, Crystal Starr talks with Andy Murphy. She was inspired to create and produce the Toasted Sister podcast. Toasted Sister expands on Andy's passion and connection with food of Native American communities.
What inspired you to start the Toasted Sister podcast, and who's your audience, and what's your message?
Yeah. So what inspired me to start the Toasted Sister podcast was getting to know just a few Native chefs in my capacity as a producer with Native America Calling. And this was, you know, 5-6 years ago. And from there, I kept following these chefs that I talked to as a producer for Native America Calling, and followed them on social media, and really saw all the kinds of different work in different areas of the country that Native people are doing to revitalize Native American food. And I thought it had to be, there has to be a little bit more about it in the media. So I got the idea from my coworker to start a podcast. And, you know, this podcast is all about Native American food. It's about this movement. It's kind of, you know, an audio journal to what's going on in this whole Native movement that's happening right now. And my audience is everybody, really. I mean, it's a podcast, so anybody can have access to it. But I hope to really target, you know, young people who are, you know, exploring food for the first time and learning about food for the first time. And I hope they can hear these stories from, you know, Native chefs and farmers and entrepreneurs in this food movement and be inspired to do something within their own Native community, even if it's just something within their own home, like introducing a new dish or learning how to cook. So, yeah, I get listeners from all over the world, really, and people who are in a lot of college students who are like doing their research papers on food or Native Americans. They're always emailing me and asking me, you know, questions about Native food. So,
can you paint us a picture of the food movement that is happening in the Native community, and what sparked this movement? And what role does Toasted Sister Podcast play in that movement?
So what sparked this movement really is colonialism. You know, when European outsiders and colonizers came to this country, you know, that was kind of the beginning of, you know, kind of beginning of the end of Native culture and along with that food. But of course, you know, we didn't all die off. They couldn't kill us off. And they couldn't kill that part of culture either. So these days, you know, people are looking back to revitalize all kinds of different parts of Native culture, including food. So this food movement is just a lot of people in a lot of different ways revitalizing these things and strengthening traditional and contemporary food ways. We have, you know, chefs who are out there putting Native food in the media and, you know, exposing, you know, the beauty of it, because people have no idea what Native American food is. So they're putting it out there, you know, as caterers, as restaurant owners, as, you know, chefs. And then there are people who are maybe in like the nonprofit world who are doing work to bring Indigenous food back to Native communities, and also pairing like the health aspect of all of this. Bringing Indigenous foods also means bringing, you know, healthy foods and good foods and, you know, just really good well-being back to Native communities. And then you have people like in a more traditional sense, maybe, who are, strengthening these Native food ways, and with that is often it's often connected with culture, you know, tradition, ceremony, things that have been passed down from generation to generation. And like for myself, Navajo food ways haven't been passed down to me, and there are a lot of people, a lot of young people like me in that kind of situation where all of these things didn't trickle down to us. So there are people in this food movement who are, you know, getting a hold of us, getting us interested in learning these food ways and tasting those traditional foods again. And Toasted Sister is just kind of a voice for all of this. I don't, you know, I'm a journalist. So that is my background, 100%. So I, through Toasted Sister, just putting a mic to all of this and putting it out in the world where people have access to it and can learn and be inspired by these stories.
Let's take a break. When we come back, Crystal Starr continues the conversation with Andy Murphy, creator of the podcast Toasted Sister. But first, more music from Last to Know. This coming January will be the band's 20th anniversary. They call their sound disco funk grass, blending world rhythms with jam band passion while obscuring the lines between Americana roots music, country, disco, funk, and bluegrass. Welcome back to Taft Center for the Arts Radio Hour. Let's get back to the conversation between Crystal Starr and Andy Murphy. Andy's podcast, Toasted Sister, focuses on Indigenous food culture.
What are some traditions? You talk about colonialism, and you talk about it being sort of the beginning of the end. What are some traditions that were stolen? I think when we talked before, I said lost, and you said, yeah, I don't want to say lost because it's not like we lost them. They were taken from us, right? So what were some traditions that were stolen or forced out of the Native culture that have been reestablished through this food movement?
Well, there's still a lot of work to be done to reestablish a lot of these things, but I can't really like get into the specifics of it all because I'm not myself like really connected to these traditions. But you know, I'm talking about you know, certain kind of ceremonies that are connected with Indigenous food, you know, certain kinds of you know, traditions that are connected to recipes and foods. And I'm talking about just like food knowledge, knowledge of your ancestral food. That's wild. That's Indigenous, just like you are, to this specific place. Like me in the Southwest and in Navajo territory, I don't know what there is to eat out there because that knowledge was forcefully taken out of my probably like my great grandma's generation. So, you know, there's that kind of food knowledge, just knowing what's out there to eat, knowing where those ancestral seeds are too, because there's a lot of agriculture in Native America. And part of the whole food movement is establishing that traditional agriculture, reestablishing those seeds back into the Native community. So, you know, seed knowledge, agriculture knowledge, knowledge of like foods and just cooking. That's more like in a contemporary sense too. I mean, and that's for all of us in, you know, this Western world. A lot of people don't know how to cook or have a passion for cooking, even though it's something that we do. We eat every single day until we die, but people don't cook, don't know how to do it. So that is most recently stolen from all of us. So in this food movement, we're trying to reestablish those things. But I think, you know, indigenous chefs are really doing some cool things with maybe like fusing different flavors and techniques together, because, you know, you can only be as dedicated as, like, you know, grilling in the backyard. You're not gonna like build a pit and a fire and, you know, do things like the old, very traditional way. I mean, I'm sure if our ancestors had access to Ziploc bags or foil or
even mason jars, right?
Even mason jars, yeah, they would totally use them. So, you know, we're adapting these things to now, but I think it's cool that the flavors are probably still the same.
So we were talking about the challenges. What are some challenges faced by Indigenous communities that are a direct result of separation from the land and cultural traditions? And then how does your work as a Native woman and as a Native journalist influence the healing of some of that generational damage and support the future of the youth?
Okay. All right, challenges that come from separation of land and food knowledge. I think, you know, the health disparities that Native Americans face today is a result of those challenges that are presented from separating us from traditional food knowledge from the land. You know, I think also poverty is another challenge people are up against. I mean, you know, with the kind of poverty that is just in Navajo Nation, I mean, it's hard to have access to food. It's hard to have access to healthy food. And it's hard, you know, I can imagine it's hard to just be excited about food when you don't have the money for it. You don't have maybe all the dishes and the tools for it. Or you're looking at all these food magazines and you see really expensive ingredients and you know you can't make it happen in your own kitchen. So I always think about you know, my life and what it was like growing up on the reservation. And, you know, I'm kind of blessed that right now I can cook whatever I want. I could go to the grocery store anytime I want and buy pretty much whatever I want. And I know I have that kind of privilege. You know, so my work as a podcaster, I just want to, you know, put all of these awesome, you know, food initiatives in a accessible place through a free podcast, a podcast you can download from anywhere and listen, you know, pretty much from anywhere. And with any of the, you know, visual stuff that I do, photography, I always make sure to try to take beautiful, beautiful pictures of our food, because we don't see our food in those kinds of photos. We don't see like sexy, you know, done up food photos of Native American food, only if they're in a cookbook. But I also hope that, you know, just the style of my podcast, it's kind of casual. You know, we're storytelling, we're chit-chatting, you know, we're laughing in, you know, some of these episodes. I want to be friendly like that, so people can, you know, feel a little bit easier about like getting excited about food.
So you briefly said something about it just a second ago, but what does food and land sovereignty mean to you? And why is it important?
Well, it's important because this was all our land. This was all our land. Any land here in the United States was Indigenous land and was pretty much stolen from us. But food sovereignty, you can look at it in a couple of different ways. Food sovereignty means the ability for a tribe to feed itself, which I don't know, no tribe that I know of has that, you know, kind of set up in their community where they're growing enough food and, you know, diverse foods to feed their community. Everything kind of comes from the outside, or people from the inside are having to travel outside of the reservation of Native territory to have access to food. So there's a lot of work that a couple of nonprofits are doing to help tribes with that, to establish business in Native America. So you can look at it that way on that tribal economical level. And then you can look at it, which is my favorite part to talk about, mm-hmm. like your own personal food sovereignty, learning how to cook for yourself. And that's the most important thing that I learned from my work as a Native food writer, as a Native food podcaster, as just like a food journalist, is that we need to cook. None of this work that all of these chefs and farmers and people in this movement are doing means anything if we can't bring that into our own kitchens and into our own pantries. Like if we do get access to all these seeds, if we do get access to these ingredients and the knowledge of ingredients, it doesn't mean anything if we don't know how to cook it. I'm, an advocate for establishing that kind of personal food sovereignty.
I hear you talk a lot about cooking the food. What about growing the food and like that relationship with the land? Are some of the people who you interview and some of the chefs that you bring to the table, are they also gardeners and farmers? Do they, what is the relationship, or how do you see that relationship between the food being grown and knowing who grew the food, and then seeing it go from the gardener or the farmer to the chef, or to the home, and then prepared, and then having that connection, that relationship with where your food is being grown, who your food is being grown by.
Yeah. That's like the, kind of like the number one goal in everybody's mind is learning about where your food comes from, and making sure you're sourcing your ingredients from, somebody that you know, and, you can next level it, I guess, make sure that your foods are like native to your tribe or to that tribe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like the definition of indigenous food. That is indigenous food, is food from the land where you're standing right now. It's food that's connected to your tribe and your people that your ancestors were eating long time ago, and and just experiencing that right now. That's the most important thing in this whole food movement, is mm-hmm. reconnecting to those roots.
Really, I guess the farmers and the gardeners that you may have interviewed, how do they talk about the relationship with the land and the importance of the relationship to the land? What have you gotten from those conversations when it comes to just knowledge of land? Like, having knowledge of food is one thing, but then having knowledge of that soil and that climate and those season changes, and harvesting that food and harvesting those seeds and saving them. What have you sort of learned from having those conversations?
Well, I've had a whole bunch of farmers on, and mm-hmm. mostly, they're talking about it's always a conversation that turns into like ancestral seeds and saving those seeds and growing mm-hmm. them up. Making sure that people in the community have access to them. Land issues that pop up are, like water rights issues, climate change and pollution are something that are on a lot of farmers' minds because it directly affects them. And water rights and dams and all kinds of stuff, they're also, paying attention to and like up against. There's a lot of Native chefs too who are also farming and gardening. Mm-hmm. I know if you look at episode one of my podcast, Carlos Baca, he's Chef Carlos Baca in my first episode back in 2017. But recently he just completely changed, and he doesn't do any kind of chef work or cooking or anything like that. He doesn't do that anymore. He's farming. He just kind of completely like dropped, walked out of the kitchen and went like straight into the field. And now he's doing all kinds of really cool stuff with revitalizing, traditional agriculture ways up in Colorado. Yeah. So you know, following all of these chefs, everybody's sharing their backyard tomatoes or, you know, their tribe's community garden or an urban garden, or, you know, there are a lot of other little groups that are popping up too that are focusing on, you know, gardening.
How has your relationship with food evolved from what it was like as a child?
Oh, yeah. Growing up as a child, we grew up very poor and ate a lot of poor men's foods. Lots of meat and potatoes, meat and rice, you know, canned food, hardly any fresh vegetables. You know, me and my sister, we still, you know, look in the produce section and we're like, God, look at all this fresh stuff here, because we never grew up with it. And when I went off to college after high school, that was the first time I moved, you know, off the reservation. And that was when, you know, everything took off. I was just hungry after that, you know, having the freedom to eat at whatever restaurant I wanted to, having the freedom to, you know, buy whatever kinds of foods and snacks that I wanted to. And then when I left college and became a reporter, I started eating a lot more like cultural foods from around the world. And so I ate at almost all the restaurants in Las Cruces, and that just like awakened a passion of food for me. And that's where I was just like, I gotta dedicate myself to food, because I don't know what else I'm gonna do in life. So eating became like buying foods and stocking certain foods, new foods in my pantry, and just learning how to cook. So right now, cooking is like one of my most favorite things to do ever. I love cooking, and I love going out and eating new foods and you know, expanding my palate. I think that, you know, it's just so valuable. Now, yeah. You know, my pantry is a whole lot different now than what it was growing up. I've got, you know, fresh foods. I've got, you know, foods from all over the place, indigenous foods from a couple of different tribes. And every week or so, I make myself a list of foods that I want to eat for maybe the month. And they'll include like four or five like brand new dishes I've never, ever tried before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a challenge. I love that challenge in the kitchen.
That was Andy Murphy, creator of the podcast Toasted Sister, talking with Crystal Starr. TCA Radio Hour is brought to you in part by our local business partner, Common Fire, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. And thank you to KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at TruthHouseRadio.com. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you all so much for tuning in. I'm Chelsea. Here's Find Light from Last to Know.
Atmosphere, my weather's gray as the storm draws near. Back to